A couple of people came up about the figure that Myrna gave about $1,000 a day per person economic costs, and she rechecked her notes, and it's $1,000 per year. So an answer to your questions on the overall economic cost that this doctor stated, that it's $1,000 per person per year in this country, the economic cost. Just to let you all know that, if that were a question. All right, for the second, next part here now, where we're going to go into a little bit more about what is a drunkard or somebody who drinks too much or abuses alcohol, and the difference between that and someone who is an alcoholic. And I'm going to turn this over to this part over to Mr. Glenn White.
How was that? That fit my new Regis look? Getting these old men out of the bush and trying to doll them up to fit the modern era. Well, as I think all of you know, and I'm Glenn White, and I'm very happy to be here with all of you. it's a real opportunity. I think I have about 30 minutes to cover this materials, so I'd like to break it into two pieces. I'll give you a bit about myself and background, and then I want to go through a vital section on, as Mr. Luker stated, the difference, begin to understand the difference between a heavy drinker even and an alcoholic. There is a physiological situation which is not to make that an excuse whatsoever, but there is a physiological problem. And that's also should bring on warning lights or red lights for you in your life, and better equip each one of you to understand others in maybe their situation and what you might be able to do about it. It is a vital key. You're going to hear a lot of facts today, tomorrow, and Friday. And as I was looking over the handouts myself and the notes on material that you'll be receiving, it can appear to be a little overwhelming. So hopefully just write down your questions as they come up, and there will be opportunity we can answer them. And there's no question that cannot or should not be asked in this field, okay? It's one that is highly emotional, sensitive, and I know that as I look out over this room, that probably 20 to 40% of you are carrying some buried pain because of this particular problem that afflicts our society. Okay, you're not bad people because you have been affected. And alcoholics are not bad people. Alcoholics do bad things. And there is quite a difference in that understanding. As a youngster in Seattle, that was quite a while ago, just after the flood, some will say, but my first impression of those who represented the shadowy and the mysterious world of the alcoholic were those zombie-like, ashen-faced individuals that were shuffling around Skid Row, the wino. I remember that as a kid, looking out there and seeing these people and startled half to death, that, Dad, who are these? And these specter-like people who sleep in doorways and in park benches and were shuffling because they were so crippled up and in the third and last stages of alcoholism. That was my first exposure. Well, over the decades, I've learned that this was an extreme minority. In fact, only about 1% to 3% of those people on Skid Row are truly alcoholic. They are habituates. They drink because of mental problems, because of cheap wine, dropouts, or whatever. It's an amazing figure, but all of this is provable. And so the majority of the alcoholics in the world today that we're discovering are men like the first man who set his foot on the moon, second man, Buzz Aldrin, okay, and past presidents like Ulysses S. Grant, who did most of his work by noon in his latter stages of his alcoholism because he was too far gone in the afternoon to function. The Kennedys, the L.B. Johnsons, celebrities like Elizabeth Taylor, Dick Van Dyke, almost two-thirds of all of the Hollywood personalities that we know of, the who's who of Nashville, Tennessee, congressmen, corporate leaders, housewives, world leaders such as Winston Churchill, Khrushchev, seniors, teenagers, sometimes preteens. More and more preteens are in recovery. And Church of God members. That was startling, but Church of God members.
Glenn?
Yes?
The night before the division of Europe occurred with the four greats after World War II, three of the four got drunk. The one who did not was the one who got the most, and that was Stalin. He didn't get drunk that night. It was FDR and Churchill and one other.
Probably de Gaulle.
But at any rate, and who ended up being able to think more clearly the next morning?
When you think of, and we're going to get to genetics. You know, our spiritual genetics came from God at conversion, right? Your physical genetics came from your parents, and your parents came from different groups and families, basically from the world. And as Mr. Luker mentioned that, you know, we're beginning to understand this, that all of a sudden we're not a sacrosanct. We are individuals that have come in from the world, and we bear our genetics. But I do want to mention that my first impression of the alcoholic was that they're bad people. And it sort of came down through the line then that I'm a bad person if, in fact, that I am alcoholic or even someone thinks I am. And that has to be fought. And our religious training throughout the church, in essence, many years ago, then this might predate some of you, was that if you're sick or got a problem, it's because you have sinned. And all of a sudden we begin to absorb this bad, I'm bad. Thankfully, many of those things are being reversed. But anyways, getting back to the those that are alcoholic, I guess this might, I might encapsulate this old saying about and apply it to myself. First, I couldn't spell it. Then I realized I are one. And this occurred in my life, and I wanted to share this with you because some of us have been there, done that, didn't vote for it, didn't want it, didn't ask for it, but we got it when we've had to deal with it. But hopefully this will be able to head some things off so you don't have to go there. That's what this is all about, a preventative maintenance program or a preventative maintenance so you don't have to go there. And so these facts that we're going to give you will help you. It was 14 years after graduation and my ordination in Pasadena in 1964. It was 1978 that this crucible came about, and that's another story I can't tell you at this particular point because we don't have the time. I'd be glad to share it with you. And that was 22 years ago. And I haven't had the need to use alcohol except at Passover. I will not. I refuse not to use alcohol at Passover. God says, take wine, I'll take wine, and that's all there is to it, okay? So I know this is triggering a lot of thoughts and a lot of different emotions in each one of you. I can almost feel the energy beginning because this is a highly emotional subject. And so the more we can understand it, the more we can take the fear out of it. No one asks for this condition. No one wants it. But we must have to learn to live with it. And one of the big words in life then in this area is acceptance. This is what is, and I must do something about it. The diabetic must face the same thing. If you have a health problem, you must face the same thing. If you have allergies, you must do the same thing. You must accept it, work with it, or stay sick, or at the mercy of whatever the condition is. I'd like to mention this, that I've heard this, that, you know, it's his fault, and he could have done better, or he shouldn't have done this, but think about it. Would anyone in any kind of a rational headset whatsoever say, well, I think I will become a dependent individual. I'm going to trash relationships the rest of my life, flounder through job changes, emotionally feel out of control, be a victim, have my friends leave me. Is that what anyone in their sound mind at any time would choose to do? Of course not. Okay. The alcoholic doesn't either because he doesn't ask for it. The first step of recovery for the addicted or an individual is stated in Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to realize I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. That's the first step, and that's what begins to destroy or take ego down and pride, which does support the illness and keep someone in denial. Now, Mr. Luker mentioned that we've been blessed here in the United to form a team, and he's introduced Myrna and myself and himself, and then Larry Walker will be part of this team. So for 22 years, I've been walking in programs of recovery, personal, family. Sometimes I've worked them well, sometimes I've not worked them too well. I graduated from St. Luke's in Pasadena as well in 1987. I spent three quarters of a master's program in Cal State LA, as Mr. Luker also mentioned, and unfortunately I was not able to complete the last quarter because of transfer and other considerations. But I hope that I can help make a contribution to this team effort, and with this pass on this education. There's so many things that tend to pop into mind, but I'll only be able to cover a few here. There are no stereotypes. Please get this. There are no stereotypes with alcoholism. I mentioned to you a variety of individuals and backgrounds. There is no way that you can say this particular class of people have more alcoholics than others. Some people, as a culture, drink more than others, but again, there is a difference. One way to be alerted to, say, your potential risk is to check your family tree and go back through and see if there really are any individuals in your family that are bona fide alcoholics. After 6,000 years of existence, man's genetics plays a larger part in the incidence of the disease or the creation of the condition. Adam and Eve were not alcoholic. Neither were they diabetic. Neither were they anything. But somewhere down the pike, somewhere down the line, conditions began to change, and through abuse, this condition was put into the bloodlines. And the phenomena is, once it's there, it stays there. Okay.
I just want to interject here. About 2 weeks, you know, I've been working knowing that we were coming here. About 2 weeks before I left, I went to a medical lecture at Los Encinas Hospital in Pasadena by Dr. Drew Pinsky, who is one of the premier addiction specialists in Southern California. And when you take into account that 90% of physicians failed a test regarding problems relating to alcohol abuse, the fact that there's an addiction specialist, there aren't that many. And he was asked the question about the idea that there's not a genetic component to alcoholism. And in what, you know, what did he think of that? And he says, that's a tough question. But he said, what I can tell you in my years in addiction, the field of addiction medicine, is that 97% of the time there's a genetic tendency with a person who's alcoholic. The other 3%, when people are alcoholic, it's because they are also severely mentally ill. And that was, again, about 2 to 3 weeks before I came here, Dr. Drew Pinsky. So I feel that it's important that we recognize that idea. At Harvard Medical School now, what they're saying is to treat alcoholism, to know medicine is to treat alcoholism. And what Dr. Pinsky says is that he is not doctoring his patients if he does not recognize dependency and alcoholism.
That triggers a thought, and I want to go into one of the authorities on this condition of alcoholism. The thought went right on my head. Okay, I guess I wanted to get down to Dr. Milam anyway. Dr. James Milam is one of the authorities that has been a standard in the industry or in the field now since about 1981. He wrote the book. He co-authored the book Under the Influence, and so I like to read. I think he puts it so succinctly. Then we can spin off of his material, and hopefully any questions you have, you'll write them down, and we'll have time to answer them. But Dr. Milam, on pages 32, 33, and 34 of his book, Under the Influence, says physiological situation, in other words, the physical situation, not psychology, determines whether one drinker will become addicted to alcohol and another will not. We're dealing with a physical problem primarily. The nature of the disease or of the problem creates a psychological problem that must be addressed in recovery. Once the plug is in the jug, as we say, then recovery is the emotions and the trauma that an individual's gone through. There will be health problems as well. Now, this word on the board, I can wander, can't I? Okay. Wrote this out because this is a particular chemical that is formed in the body of anyone who drinks. The alcoholic body treats this differently than the average or even the abusive drinker. And the phonetic is acid all... Yeah, right. Aldehyde. Acid. I still can't say that. Myrna will have to say it for me.
Acetaldehyde.
Acetaldehyde. See there? Nothing to it. Okay. Acetaldehyde, the intermediate byproduct of alcohol metabolism, appears to be one of the major villains in the onset of alcoholic drinking. The trouble probably begins in the liver. The same amount of alcohol produced very different blood acetaldehyde levels in alcoholics and non-alcoholics. Much higher levels were reached in alcoholics. There's a blockage. The body does not process alcohol the same way as in the body of the non-alcoholic. And it's nothing you vote for. And by the way, some people experience this with the first drinker of their lives, whether it's at age 10, 15, 25, or 35. The first time they take a drink, it is not something they have done to themselves because of severe or abusive drinking. It is the condition is there, the alcohol will trigger, and it's off to the races. Now, I know the thought I wanted to bring to you. If you take a look back at our 6,000 years of human history, and we take a look at, as it were, the purer product that God created in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve. Now, how many of you know that story about the penny doubled every day? Would you rather a penny doubled every day, or would you like to have $10,000? Well, take the penny. Why? Because it comes out to about $1.5 million. But it doesn't begin to really expand until when? 27th day. Where are we in the 6,000 years of creation, since creation? Near the end time. So that which we find spotty, and Lot is a classic example of an alcoholic as opposed to Noah. We'll get to that more. We find down through the ages, but then in the latter days, we begin to see the prophecies burgeoning out. So some of the major problems prophesied about our nation is chemical dependency as well as the sexual problems. You might think about that. So we have today then a problem that we can see and define far more clearly than we could even 30 years ago, 40 years ago, because that penny keeps doubling with each generation because of the genetic factor. Okay. Studies at the University of California, San Diego, confirmed that in alcoholics, the breakdown of acetaldehyde, I'll just say it my way, into acetate, which is a second step in alcohol metabolism, is performed at about half the rate of normal. Normal non-alcoholic metabolism. It is this slowdown in metabolism that apparently causes acetaldehyde. Yeah. To accumulate. Okay. Then Dr. Milam goes on. He discovered that the liver mitochondria is a little guy that goes in and out of the cell in your body and takes nutrients back and forth and so forth, or allows that to happen. The mitochondria in the alcoholics is abnormal and unable to change, there's that word again, acetaldehyde into acetate at a greater rate as in non-alcoholics. Significantly, this low rate capacity was evident even in the early stages of heavy alcohol consumption, indicating the alcoholic's cells are altered before he starts drinking heavily and continually. Now, here's a fact also. There were some studies done by a man named Shuckett, or his group. Shuckett's studies with the offspring of alcoholics also indicate that the metabolic abnormality exists prior to heavy drinking. Like their alcoholic parents, the children of alcoholics before this experiment had never drunk alcohol were unable to convert acetylcholine or acetaldehyde to acetate at a normal speed. Heredity is clearly implicated in these studies.
I just want to mention that the offspring of an alcoholic has four times greater chance of becoming an alcoholic. Secondly, I want to mention that, again, out of this Dr. Pinsky's lecture, the UCLA School of Medicine was the first, and then the USC School of Medicine released a study that they have isolated the gene where one finds alcoholism. So it sort of backs up the idea that it has a genetic component. The last thing is that for males, they have begun to develop a blood test where they think that they could, you know, say, well, this person would have the tendency for alcoholism, similar to some of the tests they're doing on breast cancer, et cetera. I want to also mention that we've listed a lot of facts and figures, and he's talking about metabolism, et cetera. Most studies and most information, facts and figures and statistics about alcoholism are from men. The statistics about alcoholism in women is extremely woefully deficient because most of the studies are done by men on men. Not exactly sure about why, but that's the way it is. Information about women and alcoholism is not a lot available.
But thankfully, that's picking up rather dramatically, I think, at this time. When the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic both take a drink, the alcohol triggers an enzyme from the liver in both situations. Once this first enzyme is triggered, it meets the alcohol and we starts a process. The immediate reproduction is this acetaldehyde, which is a caustic poison. In the body of the non-alcoholic, it disappears. Another enzyme is given, and the situation is neutralized almost instantly. Okay, there's very little residue left in the body. In the body of the alcoholic, that is not the case. There is a very severe buildup of this particular chemical. Now, this starts another process to moving or to going in the body. And it's a fairly complicated process. But it does occur. Now, as this process begins, it courses its way through the body, it is attracted very pointedly toward the brain cells, the nerve cells of your mind. Okay. Now, this begins to form another, it's called the isoquinolines. It's part of the neurotransmitter system, without getting too technical about the whole thing. But it is a visible byproduct which is deposited in the nerve cell of the brain. I liken it, looks much like dandruff, but it's in the nerve cell of the brain. This little darling, this is a true opiate, a narcotic. It's 18 times more addicting than heroin. So when you see, when we're dealing with a situation like this, an individual is beginning to have a buildup like this in the brain cells, then you're going to say, he's not thinking right. Would you expect him to? Now, this, again, is not an excuse. This is a condition, and this is what the alcoholic deals with. And anyone who has a predisposition will develop this same process.
How long does it take for that to go away?
Good question. Some say long, long time.
Repeat the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. The question is, how long does it take for this condition to go away? I've heard a number of answers on this. I'll give you my personal answer. I believe that with proper cleansing and this kind of a thing, and a person does not drink, I do believe that can be cleansed out of the body. Okay. But that's kind of an unknown, at least in my area. Myrna might have some more background on that.
The craving and obsession for alcohol, as Mr. White said, can go away. The memory of the alcoholic high never goes away. Never, the brain cell never loses the memory of what it's looking for. It always knows that that's what it's after. So you can take away the alcohol, you can take away the craving and the obsession. But once that cell has been altered by the presence of a substance, it never loses the memory. And in effect, what it's saying immediately is, I know how that's going to feel. And that's why what we said earlier, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. You're not cured of alcoholism. You have a remission through treatment. But it never loses the memory of what it's looking for once it has been triggered.
So it's something, again, that we live with. We have levels of comfortability or sobriety. So much depends upon what an individual will do with and in his sobriety, okay? Some people fight the craving more than others. There's so many variables. Some of us don't have a craving. But no one ever gets foolish enough to say, let's try this again. Don't ever do that, because then you become a true statistic, and it'll take you out. As Mr. Luker said, we have lost people from the Church of God. People have lost their conversion. It's gone down the tubes. Now, again, I don't want to judge those people because I don't know all the circumstances. But I have known men in the ministry as well as those in the congregation that have been dramatically affected and have become vulnerable then to emotional situations and other pressures in their lives, and they've basically left the church. And some of their fundamental problems have been the chemical that's been in their life. This is a little bit of these nerve cells pass on information, and in here are the neurotransmitters. Okay, there's a large number of them. Alcohol, to the alcoholic, again because of the isoquinoline thing, will excite this. And so there's a rush, and there's a real rush. If you've not been there with a double shot of 151 Smirnoffs, you ain't been there. But it does an incredible thing on the human body, because, again, this is hard liquor and there's a number of other factors, but it really does have an impact. And this is increased. That's your drug effect. The receptors are saying, give me more, give me more. And it's an amazing thing. This is altered in the mind. All drugs will alter the nerve cells in the brain. And in these receptors, it begins to build up. And it actually grows more receptors. Now, in recovery, this will come back to normal or near normal. But during the active addiction, the chemical process, they actually grow, and it says, give me more, give me more. And so the craving, and there's one other thing I want to do in the next few minutes, I think is very important because it's also a visual, on this matter of addiction. Got my motor running here now. Look at it this way. Whenever this point is reached, okay, say alcohol addiction or alcohol, you become alcoholic, okay. Well, there is a thing called tolerance begins. Understand tolerance? Anyone? Anyone not, please. In other words, you can drink one, that's enough. Pretty soon two, hey, no big deal. First thing you know, you're up to a six-pack. But there's no visible signs of drunkenness or impropriety, or at least not much. That's tolerance growth. This is common to all drugs. Okay. Now, there's So what we have then with the growth of tolerance, we also then know that this is a sign of addiction. Now with what we've tried to describe here, with the growth and the change and the altering of the brain cells and the receptors wanting more and more and more, we have then the addiction continues to grow, continues to expand. In the process, and we don't know exactly, this is different with each different individuals, there is a collapse of the tolerance. So now the addiction is growing, but the ability to handle the intake of alcohol diminishes. So now instead of a six-pack, this fellow's in trouble all the time, so he cuts it back to four, but then he's got this problem.
I just want to mention on this that what he's saying is that the amount of alcohol ingested by an addicted or an alcoholic person would kill the normal person. That's why I like when we have these articles about young people in colleges guzzling, that they die. The alcoholic could consume that same amount of alcohol as a daily course. The difference between dependence and heavy drinking lies in the area of withdrawal and tolerance. That's the difference between the heavy drinker and the alcoholic. They do not develop the same kind of tolerance nor the same kind of withdrawal symptoms.
Right. This is when the individual is really in trouble and his problem becomes more public, the DUIs, the inappropriate relationships, the lying, the cheating, bum checks, because at this point, very important, alcohol becomes the center. The housewife that goes to the supermarket on Friday, the first trip, the first stop is at the coolers. Oh, long weekend, back, make sure we don't run out. When they have a church picnic, we all go to a park which says, and there's a prohibition on alcohol, who's got it in their cooler? Who has it disguised with the long straws? Five people are going home. Who gets the two? They each have a beer, one last one for the road. Who puts the last other one in their belt underneath the front seat of the car? See? Who always knows where there's a bootlegger just in case? Just in case the weekend becomes too long and has too much company? These are all telltale signs. Okay. And I think I'm out of time. Okay, so with that, I'll return this to Mr. Luker so we can stay within the time constraints.
Thank you, Glenn, for sharing that with us. Yeah, we are pretty much finished with this session now. I do have another handout if one of you would mind passing this to everybody. It's a commonly used definition of alcoholism. The first paragraph will give you an explanation of why alcoholism is called a disease. I know that throws some today, but call it an illness, call it a sickness. Yes, a question on this.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about what you're talking about. It's in the genes that you have alcoholism in your family tree.
If you are the child of an alcoholic, you have a 4 times greater chance of being alcoholic. So, no, it's not necessarily true that you will be. You have a 4 times greater chance.
It seems like, from my experience, that I can see some, if you go to the next generation, some seem to be susceptible to
yes.
that. Others don't.
That's what I'm saying. Not all will. Just like you may have parents with brown eyes and blue eyes. Not every kid's going to have brown eyes. The same with alcoholism. You know, if you have 4 kids, you may end up with 2 alcoholic, 2 non-alcoholic.
Well, we'll cover that in more detail tomorrow, the genetic predisposition. Some people, most people, 90% of the population can stop drinking. They can control it. They're abusers. But approximately 10% of people, there is a genetic factor that makes them addicted to alcohol, and they're not even aware of it. And unless you've been addicted to something, I don't know if any of you have been addicted to sugar, alcohol, anything, an addiction becomes a very powerful thing, and it can control your life. So we will get into that more tomorrow to try to answer your questions when we have more time. Thank you for those questions. We want the questions. We need the questions so that we can make sure we are addressing the things that you want to know more about and to answer any questions you may have.